I'm Olympic and world champion diver, Laura Wilkinson, and this is the Pursuit of Gold podcast. Each week, we are unlocking the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual tools that help athletes reach their biggest goals in sports. Today's guest never had big Olympic aspirations growing up. He simply found a sport that he loved, and it gave him the direction, discipline, and focus that he needed in his life at that time. From this simple beginning, John Root found his way onto the Stanford University team, became a three-time AVCA All-American, and was eventually inducted into Stanford Athletics Hall of Fame. But that's just the beginning. John decided he wanted to see just how far he could go in volleyball. He earned his way onto the U.S. national team, then became part of the Pan Am Games team that went on to win a gold medal. And then he found himself a year later at the Seoul Olympic Games on top of the podium. He went on to play professionally in Italy and beach volleyball as well. He also worked with the U.S. Olympic Committee and various sponsors during both the 1996 and 2000 Olympic Games. He's now written two books that focus on performance, transformation, life, and sports, and he coached club volleyball for 17s and 18s. John is passionate about helping athletes understand there's a definitive process to excellence and how they can really begin to stand out while developing a love for what they're doing. Pursuit peeps, it's an Olympic year and Paris is looming right around the corner. If you want to make your big event extra special with some Olympic inspiration, I would love to be your keynote speaker. Contact me for more information at laurawilkinson.com/speaking. That's laurawilkinson.com/speaking. Before we get started, make sure you smash that subscribe or follow button and give us a 5-star review. But even more importantly, please share your favorite episodes with your friends. That is the best way for us to grow so that we can continue to bring you more resources, tools, and inspiration. All right, I believe that there's gold in your future, so let's dive on into this episode. John Root, welcome to the Pursuit of Gold podcast. I'm so excited to have you on and your cat that is trying to already steal the show.
For some reason, it's like he doesn't like speakerphone. Who knows? Anyways, you might hear him. His name's Cooper. It's all good. Laura, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to just be with you, follow your career. So I'm a big fan and it's all good.
Well, thanks. Well, I'm super excited to have you on. My daughter is a volleyball player and I told you it just lights her up. So I like feel really cool that I'm talking to one of the best and greatest nice. Hall of Famers. So I want to know how it all started for you, because I don't think you started in volleyball, did you?
I did not. That's a very good insight. I grew up in West Los Angeles and I went to an all-boys high school and I was a baseball player. That's where I thought I was headed. You know, I was one of those kids that just had a whip for a right arm. And that was kind of what I thought I was doing. I kind of didn't really look far ahead. And ironically, waiting for baseball season, which was a spring sport, I was playing basketball at school, got hurt, you know, cast on my arm, kind of weeping, watching the guys go through spring practice. And the volleyball coach came up to me and said, "Hey, have you ever played?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you know, grew up, I've done the beach, done little things." He's like, "Well, when you get healed, why don't you come out and, you know, see what it's all about?" I love the guys. I loved kind of the whole thing. And it was like a hockey stick for me. It just like, I never looked back. It was weird.
Oh, that's awesome. Good. That's cool. Well, so maybe it's different in California, because where we are, there's not much men's or boys volleyball. Like, they're just starting to try to have it in some of the clubs around here. Is it totally different in California? Like, has it always been a big sport there?
It is. The men's side has always been much less than the women's side. You know, I mean, Texas is prolific for girls club volleyball. You all see this. My daughter left California to go to Texas because they just take it to a whole other level. Mm-hmm. They do it really well there. Boys volleyball has grown. It's been primarily kind of East Coast, West Coast thing, but there is some things happening in the South and Florida. It's been good to see, but the club these days is fairly evenly mixed. I was coaching boys club, so the pipeline is happening, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But primarily, I grew up in California. It's like water polo. It's one of those things we kind of, you know, our brethren, mm-hmm. we go hand in hand and it thrives out here. So
that's cool.
It was just a hotbed when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so doing the whole recruiting process and stuff, and I know it was, you know, a little while ago. So the landscape of recruiting and everything has changed. Was volleyball like at a lot of the schools, or did you just have your eye on Stanford and you're like, this is it. This is the only place I'm looking at.
It's funny because I'm almost embarrassed to say this. Somebody had asked me in my process as a junior, are you applying to Stanford? And I was like, where's that? I grew up in LA and I was like, I went to a high school near South Central. I mean, I was in the hood near SC, you know, so it was SC, UCLA, Hawaii, Santa Barbara, Harvard, but it was kind of a different mix. I'm not an East Coaster. And then it was, okay, where can I go to kind of play if I have an impact? Fortunately, I had the academic side and it completely flipped. Once I got into Stanford, it was like, I'm done. I'm all in. And it was the best decision I ever made.
That's cool. So what was your experience like at Stanford?
You know, it was phenomenal. I was a little overwhelmed because I think coming from SoCal, you know, while I went to a really strong all boys Jesuit high school, and so academics were highly placed. And I think some of that was, I was fortunate to be the scholar athlete coming out of the graduating class. But I never had really hung around that intense of an intellectual crowd on a day in and day out basis, mm-hmm. including athletes. And so I kind of felt like, you know, here I was, I'm not going to training this afternoon. You know, they're, oh, what do you mean? But it was fantastic. The people, the minds, the experience, the opportunities that I was provided, and I went to a program that wasn't overly dominant. So what was important for me was that as best I could as a freshman, I was on the court, you know, day one. And that was the world. You know, I was a pioneer that eventually went on to win a couple of national championships. We didn't do much when I was there, but I'm okay with that. You know, I'm in the Hall of Fame at Stanford. I'm grateful. I love the institution. It's been a rocky road on some levels with some of the things that have gone down in the last couple of, you know, 3-4 years. And with this whole thing about, you know, going to the ACC, and I'm really torn about that. I'm mm-hmm. old school. I grew up with Pac-8, Pac-10, Pac-12. But for all intents and purposes, you know, Stanford in those days, it's tightened up a little bit as a vibe. And I think most educational institutions have at the high level for a lot of different reasons. But when you were a, you know, a scholar athlete, it was an awesome experience. It really was.
That's awesome. And I love that you're in the Stanford Athletics Hall of Fame. Like when I got into the Texas Hall of Honor, like I didn't even realize what a big deal it was. You know what I mean? Like it was very cool. And I mean, you know, you love your college experience, but I don't think when we're going through it, sometimes we realize the gravity of what's happening around us or what we've done, you know? And so then to be recognized years later, it's like, oh, okay. Like, okay, that was a big deal. That's really cool. Yeah, like people noticed,
you know? I totally agree, Laura. Like the Olympic experience, you know, and going through that whole thing, it settled into a greater degree, a higher magnitude later. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of just sit back and go, you're getting me all emotional here, but it is. You're proud. You feel grateful. You know, the timing, people acknowledged you. You know, for me, the whole Stanford thing, when they told me I was going as a ride and respected that way, I wanted to give everything I had to that institution. You know, mm-hmm. whatever I could do to give back on the back end, I was just grateful. So to me, it was the best experience of my life because it kind of matriculated me into the Olympic movement without me even having that framed up as a dream or as an objective. And so that was what was especially cool about my moments there.
I love that. Let's take that little springboard off. So you were just like, I'm just focused on college and that was it. And then how did that change into like developing you into this, I want to go to the Olympics and then continuing to be a professional athlete? Like you took a totally different route.
Yeah. And it's funny. And I'm going to lead into this because, you know, and all these different things that we have with all of our people that have been in the Olympic movement, and you hear so many stories about people dreaming about it. And I kind of like would always like, God, you know, like I felt a little strange because that wasn't the way it was for me. I mean, baseball, when I was in high school, I wasn't even thinking about college. So I had mm-hmm. to reframe, you know, I was going to look at a high school draft and then completely different switch. Hockey stick, I'm top 5 in the country. You know, here I am, you know, on potential. And so that matriculated with great coaches and an environment where I could kind of train and really focus. All that being said, I didn't really understand the end game of volleyball. I didn't know what could I do with this? You know, where could I go? What, you know, it was kind of in the here and now. I think just the way that I grew up, I had an interesting story. I left home when I was really young, before I was 12. And so there was a lot of the back history around my books is that kind of sports saved me from myself, so to speak, as I matriculated through competition, but also post-competition in life and trying to grapple with that. But I think in some ways I was so afraid of failure that I just was so ramped in year one, year two, year three, year four. By the time I had finished all my peer group competitions, junior nationals or world games for the under 20, U20, I had done that a year ahead of my peer group. So I basically was like, I asked my coach, I'm like, hey, can you call Marv down at the national team and ask him if he'll let me come down and train with the team for the summer? I kind of want to see what I got. Where's this headed?
Yeah.
And that was how it all started. And everybody, my peer group juniors were off going doing something. And I went down to the national team and just got the door open. Timing wise, it just was phenomenal.
That's really
cool. I got
cool.
to get some exposure without the whole competition group around me. Got my foot in the door, trained, got better, and just had a kind of head start on the process. So it was a blessing in disguise.
Well, I love that you mentioned the Olympics weren't your dream originally. You were like, kind of, you had your hand over your head, like, oh, you know, I feel weird about that. Because that's what you hear from.
I was like, what's wrong with me?
But like, we're all allowed to have a different journey. We're all allowed to have that light bulb moment at different times. Like, I talked to so many athletes and nobody has exactly the same. There's a lot of similarities and we all face challenges. And there are things that are similar in a lot of athletes' journeys, but we're all having a very unique journey. So it's okay if it doesn't look like the person next to you, you know, doing this amazing thing. Like, we all have the right to have our own journey. And that's what makes it beautiful, right? So
We're unique people doing unique things, you know
exactly.
what I mean?
Exactly. So for those of our listeners that may not have the journey that they've heard other people on the show, and it sounds like yours is a little different, do you mind sharing what some of that beginning looks like and why it was so different?
Well, you know, there's a lot tied up in, I think, my writings, which is how my book started. There was a lot of childhood drama. You know, by the time I was 11, I had decided before my 12th birthday, I'm done. I'm out. I'm leaving. Can't do this anymore. And thank goodness I found a compatibility with people, structure, and just, I think, overall positive input through sports and sports performance. It was a vent. It was a place to express. It was a place with no pressure, no worries. Yeah. And I played with the old people. I came in as a kid, you know, I went down to the park with the old men and tried to figure it out, you know. And that was kind of the story, the early story of my days. But it was, I feel very blessed that I came off the assembly line wired. And that's why in my writings, I refer back to that sports kind of saved me from myself, because everything I did, I was good at. Mm-hmm. And that was so rewarding to me that it became self-fulfilling. At that age, I didn't understand pride, but I understood the process of the work ethic in the sense of, okay, well, what happens if there's an obstacle? No big deal or big challenge? How am I going to handle this? And I'm talking when I was 11, you know, you don't really think you know any better, but I learned some sneaky tricks from the old men, you know, and that really helped me kind of become older faster.
Get that wisdom early. Yeah.
Yeah. Because as much as I feel I was physically blessed, there was a side of life that was the non-material, it was the non-physical that kind of became, you know, my play people, my friends, my guides, you know, my teachers, the philosophy, the spiritual. And it's not a God thing. It's just I understood at the moment that there's more to this than just the bread and butter. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of when I started the path of learning and kind of seeing what else is out there besides, you know, when somebody says, be the ball. You know, you kind of laugh back in the 70s, but being the ball became a mindset and it became a practice.
What does that mean to be the ball? I come from a non-ball sport. So like, what does it mean to be the ball?
Sorry. So, you know, I think there was this whole thing, you know, and I grew up in the 80s, matriculated at Stanford and kind of the hippie, you know, high-end movement, but there were all these people that had different things, but there was all these things about becoming your object in the moment. You know, there's a distorting, or how do I say this? Breaking down the distortion between you and your end object, your goal. Okay. And if you are in a sport, diving, maybe it's getting lost in the visualization of the move or the dive or the technique and seeing that over and over in your head. That's being the dive, so to speak.
Okay, got it.
In volleyball, in motion and movement, it's see yourself in that activity. Be that which you think you want to do, even though you don't really know how to do it right now. So it was kind of the seed of manifestations. How do you visualize things? I think that was my early lesson in visualizing things, which was a really potent additive to some of my development work.
Yeah, dude, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. That's really cool. Starting to have those perspectives at such a young age too, because like you said, you were training with the old guys, you know, you're learning things that maybe the other juniors weren't learning. You know what I mean? You're at a different level. That's pretty cool. So you're going to see things different. And that's awesome.
Which is what really got me guided on. You really respect, there's a lot of respect for the wisdom of the game. I don't care where you're from or how good you are, but especially when I was coaching, I really try to impress upon people to, there is a process and, you know, the fundamentals and the good information and the good techniques and the good things make a big difference. So try what you can to really embrace that now.
Going back to this, like, school is leading you to the national teams and you're starting to like compete and travel, not just nationally, but internationally. Walk us through like Pan Am Games and Olympics. Like, what was that whole kind of journey like for you?
The junior year for me was really mind-blowing because I was coming into a team that won the gold in 84. This is Karch Karai and Craig Buck and Steve Timmons and Dusty Dvorak, who were the 84. Karch is now our women's national team head coach, who had great success last go-round. He's been an amazing story. But these guys didn't have... They had the boycotts, so they had a chip on their shoulder, and a core of them decided to stick around. There wasn't a lot of room at the inn, as they say. So I think 8 to 10 of the guys transitioned and continued on. So when I came down in the summer of 85, I walked into the gym and I was just slack-jawed. I mean, I was just like, can I do this? You know, like you're looking around going, yeah, you, oh boy. And so it was basically, you know, nose to the grindstone, keep your head down. Yes, sir. No, sir. How do you, thank you very much for the opportunity. And you just do what you're said to do. You know, you carry ball bags and whatever. And I made every single trip that summer. And it really kind of gave me a boost in my heart that I at least didn't fail. And so the following year, when I graduated college, June 86, things were in full swing. Team getting ready for the world championships in 86 in Paris, joined in June 15th. And I never got dropped from a travel squad. And it was like, wow. But for 2.5 years, I was a rookie. You know, you're always in that moment of gripping, just like, is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? You know, and it's like, that's a long time. I'll never forget the moment when we had our team meetings, you know, 120 days out from the games, and the guy in front of me came out crying and I knew I'd made the team.
Wow. Yeah. What was the process? I don't know if it's changed. I know every sport has such a different process. It's always evolving.
Yeah. Team sports, it's very subjective. You know, we're the national team. And then in the year of the Olympics, we become the Olympic team, but it's essentially just another roster. So we trained in those days, 10 months out of the year, for the most part. You know, we were on the road 165 days a year.
Wow.
There is a program in place for, you know, the 18-month ramp up to the games. Final rosters, I think, for team sports have to be submitted 120 days out from opening day, opening games, opening ceremonies. And there was a guy, I was a utility player, but I served many different roles. So I'm looking at maybe 11th or 12th spot. We carry 12, travel 12. And there was a guy who'd been there for 3.5 years training in front of me. And I don't know what was said behind the closed doors, but I knew brokenheartedly, I mourned for him. But I knew at that moment, I was like, oh my God, I think I just made this team.
Wow.
You know, he never spoke to me again. Can't say that I took his spot, but it's a coaching decision. And, you know, and I was just like, this was the number one team in the world that I was stepping onto. So I'm kind of glad to say I was glad to make the team.
Yeah. So what was it like going to the Olympics with this like amazing team? And you guys had just come off winning the Pan Am Games the year before, right?
So yeah, sorry. The 87 Pan Am Games actually got a lot of exposure.
It was in the U.S., right?
Correct. Indianapolis. Great crowd. Great everything. Great organization. Generally, that's a weaker tournament for us. It depends on who's there and who sends their senior team. But what was interesting about post-Pan American Games, which we did win, in 87, we had then won the World Cup in 85, the World Championships in 86. And so now the national team was headed for the Triple Crown, which no other team other than the Soviets had done that. So I was just sitting here going, you know, I'm sitting looking at these guys who had changed the nature of volleyball. I mean, they just totally shifted the power game. So for me, it was like, here I am on this team and I'm like training up against my Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan every day. You know, how can you not get better?
Yeah.
You're just trying to kind of stay relevant. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really amazing experience because I had an opportunity to sit and observe and break down the best in times of peak moments, you know, and we were the number one seed going into the 88 Olympics. The ramp up.
Let me ask you a question about that, because it's one thing to be an underdog and fighting for something. It's a whole different thing to know you've got a target on your back. What was the team's mindset going into that? Like, how were you guys trying to think about it to have the best opportunity for success there?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you a very strange transmission. And this was the vibe that I took from this. And that's a very good question. It was 3 days out. We were going with our last kind of hard gym time prior to kind of a taper. Things were so intense. Nobody was talking to each other. You could just feel it. And I could look around and see guys like Karch, and everybody has their way of, like, you know, handling all this stuff because he was the point person, you know, but there were two other three other people, players that the media had their eyes on. And you could just kind of look at these guys and try to understand what they were going through as we looked to defend, because it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. I knew after the coach rolled out the ball, he said, "You guys get after it. We're done after this." And that was one of the most insane, intense workouts. People were swearing at each other. They were fighting, you know, like chipping under the... I just was like, oh my God, this is ours to lose. I knew. It just was this weird feeling. I was like, oh my God, they're going to have to kill us to take this from us. And it played out. We had one scare against Argentina. But other than that, it was a pretty impressive run. I'm a bench player looking at these guys taking this on every day. It was impressive.
Did you actually get any playing time in the games?
Yeah, I did. Like three of the matches, you know, nothing that was overly relevant like I had been in other series, just because at that point you're gripping. Mm-hmm. So I didn't expect much. A couple of the reserves got in. Scott Fortune, my teammate at Stanford, got put in and put over the last play to seal the game. Mm. So we celebrated that together. I think for me, it was the pride of just being able to be a part of that crew, you know?
Yeah.
It was a little different perspective than being able to say, hey, I was completely responsible, like a Karch, you know, who we rode that guy, you know, his mentality. It was rare to have somebody like that in this phase of the game. He was just an unbelievable player.
Kind of like a Michael Jordan type.
It was. I mean, you could see, like, in the Russians in the finals, we lost the first set to them out of the best of five. We crushed them in the second set, and you could literally, the faces of our guys, we were so confident that it was weird. It wasn't emotional. It was business and this kind of like quiet cockiness, but locked in. And you could just see the Soviets, just their faces just dropped. They were just like, oh, and we ended up just kind of, you know, wiping the court the next two games. And so it was a good place. I'm really proud of that whole thing. Really proud. Yeah.
Now that's really cool. So getting a gold medal and all that too, and being part of that, like, you just say you're proud, but like, what did it feel like coming home, I guess, after that? Cause you're in Korea, you're in South Korea to get this medal. You know, did people know what happened at home? Like, were things
different? They did
not,
you know, like my mom or my dad and my stepmom were there. I had a couple of friends that traveled to the games. I had connected with one of the divers, Wendy, who had won bronze. She was coming back to the West Coast. And so, like, we ended up in the same city. And all of a sudden, I find out my best friend's family is, like, you know, throwing this party. And, you know, I'm trying to wake up from no sleep. And I think at one point, I kind of went off to the side before all of the things. And I just kind of had a quiet cry because it was so overwhelming. You're like, oh, my God, I just represented my country. And we just rocked it, you know?
Yeah.
And the gratitude, I didn't even really know what to say. I think I was just so lost in the humility and the kind of what just happened, you know, and it really doesn't settle in right away. It became much more of an honor, I think, as some time passed, especially, you know, I have friends who have been in four Olympics and have not been on the podium, you know, and so you hear these stories of dedication, and I just either got lucky or, you know, it was just kind of the way things seemingly shaped.
Yeah.
So I feel very grateful, very blessed.
That's awesome. From that point, were you kind of wondering what to do? Did you know you were going to keep going? Like, what was that transition point like? Because I don't know back then if it was easy to make a living from doing volleyball. Like, I mean, there's a lot of sports now where it's really a struggle to do stuff post-college and continue going after like Olympic games and stuff. So what was that part of your journey like?
It was difficult. It was a little more difficult than actually I was playing overseas. And this is kind of a twisted story for me personally, because my college coach had taken over the national team for the 92 games. And I had left the national team 2 years prior under kind of a personal duress situation. I kind of lost my shit. My stepmom was diagnosed with cancer. And we were getting ready to, like, you know, play in the world championships. And I let my team down. I had to step away because I felt I just couldn't carry the obligation. And I think that was held over my head later because I was not really in consideration for the 92 team. And this was, you know, communicated not very well from a guy who trained me to become what I was. So it was this weird, like, maybe the world is just kind of telling you something. I went overseas and was playing in Europe professionally for 3 years. I ended up having a very powerful meditation experience where I realized that I was done. I was just done. I had to kind of finally get and back to know this guy who entered this world so angry and so good at something that, you know, my body was broken down. I think my brain was broken down. I didn't know what to do for work. I didn't really know if there were resources for mental health at that time. I was just kind of lost. Had some money in the bank, so I didn't really worry about it, you know, but I truthfully can look back and say it was kind of a mess. I was a good mess. But I was kind of a mess. And that led me more into taking personal time to kind of really have to dive back into the pre-12, start taking a hard look at how I was wired and what did sports do for me. And in looking at those things, I did suffer from not having the structure of sports. And I also suffered from not having the vent of being able to just burn it, you know?
Yeah.
So things internalized and kind of compressed for me. And I changed as a person, and it wasn't for the better. That's hard to admit, but it is what it is. It started a long path of kind of 10 to 15 years of, you know, just healing and personal transformation work, which is where the books came in, because I had to figure out a way to kind of stay engaged, stay relevant.
I totally understand that. And we actually just had someone on the podcast recently talking about how she is now coaching athletes on this transition because we are finding such a big gap. Because, like, especially, like, I mean, it's hard enough leaving college and trying to figure out what you want to do and who you want to be, right? But if you've done sports beyond college and you've not even had that time to figure out kind of what you're going to do outside of sports, and then now you're this, like, adult person with kind of no other resume than sports, like, and you don't know how to live your life without a coach, without teammates, without a structure, like, it is very hard. Like, and a lot of athletes have gone through that struggle. I can totally relate to being lost too. I've totally experienced that as well. So,
and Laura, I want to interject there. The thing that crushed me, and yes, on all those, was that I understood something in the athlete world that is probably universal about the trust, the respect, the handshake, the respect. You get outside of the cream or the cream of that crop. And in the business world and in life in general, that ain't so much. So you come in trying to apply, like, this, oh, you know, kind of good intentional thing. And I got eaten by the sharks, and it was very humbling.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your books. You have two, The Life, The Spiritual Sport, and then Heart Sparking Performance. Tell us a little bit about those and how that kind of helped you move through this part of your life.
The first book, Life, The Spiritual Sport, which is no longer in print, started as an open letter to my daughter, ironically, just trying to share some of the struggles that were never spoken and never seen about kind of things that I went through. Hopefully at some point in time, if they were ever to be discussed or not. But what I had to embrace at some point in time was kind of a platform for living. And then it sounds kind of cheesy, but between my physical realm of, you know, 15 years of kind of high level international stuff, there was the subsequent 15 years of kind of breaking things down. And that was, you know, me, myself, and I. A lot of looking in the rearview mirror, trying to understand the anger, really dealing with the childhood abuse and understanding what ramifications and effects they had, you know, and a lot of it I was able to ride through sports because just, I don't know. But life, the spiritual sport, became a kind of a working metaphor for me that, you know, can life be viewed as a spiritual sport? You know, we've got our physical side, we've got our non-physical side. We're always trying to do something and, you know, perform at some level, but we always face change. And, you know, some people are better at it than others. And if you are good at performance, but you're not great at change, can you look at change in a different way? And, you know, in changing, we do perform. In performing, we do change. It's inherently part of the walnut. My focus was on the transformational component. And then ironically, overlaid against my physical performance in the first half of my life. And it was a really fascinating kind of thing. And I ended up just kind of breaking down our five general realms, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, and energetic. And kind of just, I'm a gobbler of Eastern philosophy. I've always, when I was traveling, I was really fascinated about how these cultures worshiped communist countries or open societies. And I'm talking to everything from Catholicism and Judaism to Hinduism to witches and, you know, warlocks. So there was a big important interplay for me around like things that were never really taught in sports. These concepts which people have placed on Eastern, but it's just internal systems that are not visible. They're not tangible. And so I became very fascinated in the integration of, okay, let's look at the emotional realm. You know, what would be an example of how do you deal with challenge? You know, or one example is if you look at our five primary emotional categories, anger, fear, worry, sadness, and grief, and joy. Okay, those five, four out of those five are essentially like negative. Mm-hmm. We end up managing or reacting to each one of those on a day in and day out basis. We don't actively seek to create worry, create anxiety. So if joy is the only thing, these things become or can be become debilitating. So how does that factor into mental strength or mental health or your reactions? And so I kind of went through this whole process of just creating MEMS and workable little digestible pieces to try to help to see how these are individually handled, you know? People talk about, oh, it's positive perspective. Well, that's not all it is. You know, what happens if you have an anxiety disorder? So there's different things at play. And I try to, it's a little esoteric, but I feel that it has a pretty good fabric.
Very cool. But what about the heart sparking performance?
It's more of the same, just kind of in a second half of life. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of coming into this place of, it was actually was driven off of a book from a Stanford professor. It's heart-based. You know, at the end of the day, you can think it all day long. You can want to be it all day long. But in the soft systems, in the internal systems, in the philosophical systems, you really have to kind of understand purpose, you know, especially in your later part of life. You know, I mean, I'm over 45 and it is different. And what is heartfelt? Where can you put your heart energy as a power place, you know, to maybe lockstep with your brain? And is your brain thinking clearly? Does your heart agree? So that is literally trying to heart spark your performance. You know, can you look at this in a way to make this less mental and more joyful, more passionate about what you're doing?
I love that. Heart sparking. That's so cool. I'm totally going to use that. That's awesome, John. So I know after you played professionally and stuff, you actually went to a couple of other Olympic games, but in a different avenue for a different role. So tell us about your other Olympic experiences.
So I was an AAC rep for volleyball, and I was down in Sydney in the village. There were five of us. We were kind of facilitating the grab for, you know, a lot of the athletes that were performing at the games, or if there were sponsorships that were trying to get personal appearances, we would kind of engage on all those things, you know, deal with some drama in the village. It was actually very rewarding and very interesting to see things from, I didn't have any executive pressure. We were there to facilitate. So it was, as an ex-athlete, it was a really awesome experience. And I thought Sydney did a wonderful thing. I had a funny experience. So I go down there, we have our liaison, and you know, the placards give your surname first. And so my last name Root, and he looks at me, he's like, mate, he goes, you kidding me? Your last name Root? Oh my God. We're going to have some fun with you, brother. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, do you know what to root means down here? He goes, we're going to call you the wombat. He goes, eats roots and leaves. And that'll sink in later. But apparently my surname had a very jarring effect on people down there. So they took me out and showed me off. This guy's name's Root. And everybody started laughing.
So they speak the same language, but yet it's still a very different language in a lot of ways.
Yes, they're very different people. God love them.
Oh, that's so fun.
The second role was I was working with the USOC. Bill Campbell, John Krimsky was the CEO of the time, in lockstep with Atlanta Organizing Committee and the marketing group. And we were, Benita and I, who was also a former Olympian in 84, Olympic medalist, we oversaw the NGB program. So kind of as the former products, we had a really good insight into, I can't say what their needs were for the NGBs, but we knew the community. We knew the executive directors. We were the facilitators of sort for drill down sponsorships with some of the Olympic sponsors. And there were some really great projects that came out of that. I think Synchronized Swimming did a deal with Susan G. Komen for breast cancer awareness.
Very cool.
You know, Rolex is always interested in the equestrian crowds, but we had some really functional grassroots campaigns. We Swatch did a book with Annie Leibovitz, which I was a program manager for. Mm-hmm. That was really cool. Trying to just do her black and white thing with all the hopefuls and all the Olympians, and Swatch was a part of that. That was a really artistic, I think, rewarding project. So it was the park. I think Centennial Olympic Park was a really great example of things for how they hosted everything. So a lot of positives there. It was a really great experience.
What was it like being at an Olympic Games on home soil? Like, I've been to three Olympic Games and I've done media for two others, and I've never experienced an Olympic Games in the US. Like, was it a totally different vibe?
Yeah, it was totally weird. Like, being over in Seoul for my games and then in Sydney, I actually felt a little more patriotic in a way. I don't know if it was working, you know, you're working 12 hours a day and you're like, you're trying to get through like everything that's going on, but we were going to events, you know, we had all access passes. So it was this weird, like kind of surreal thing. Like, oh my God, these are the Olympics. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't settle in until, like, for me, going to watch the beach volleyball competition, which was exhibition turned medal sport, and some of the other stuff, and just the track and field events. It was really amazing. So
yeah. That's cool.
Good times.
That is very cool. I know you've done more than you've done all the things, you know, and you've also been a volleyball coach for a while. So when you come full circle like that, and you've been a player at the high school, the junior, the college, the national team, the Olympics, international, like you've done all of the things, then you went and worked on the Olympics in a different role, and now you're coaching volleyball. Like, what is that? Like, what kind of feedback are you able to instill different things? Like, what kind of wisdom do you try to give to players when you are coaching?
You know, Laura, it's the last, especially, I can say this for club volleyball because I coached boys and girls. The girls has gotten a little more intense over the last 7 years. You know, there's a lot of investment by the families. And so, you know, while coaching for 6 years, you try to look at how can I possibly impact these kids? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, my goal going back was just imparting what I thought was a very good toolbox of information that I had collected over time that I didn't see or hear anywhere, which was, and the following is kind of funny because I had some parents like, well, do you know what you're doing? You know, and I'd be like, yeah, well, how do I, you know, so there was all these qualifications about my pedigree, but long story short, there's trying to help kids get into college. You know, I think that was, if I can do anything, it's, can I get the needle moved far enough to where you go where you want to go on your terms? I think that's the most positive aspect, you know, and if it doesn't happen, great. But so there's Coach John, that's the technical coach. I'm old school. I'm kind of a Wooden-esque kind of guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a middle blocker. And so there's ways things have to happen. You know, I can't control everything, but I learned what I couldn't coach, or you don't have time to coach. But the other side of it was to really try to have these kids lean into some of my experience on a one-on-one basis about what I had gone through. You know, is there anything in here that you can tap into that will possibly help you phase, next phase, or philosophically going forward? You know, most of these kids came from pretty sound backgrounds. So my story was unique and interesting. And we all sat down after tournaments and, you know, talk stories. And it was very cool to just, oh my God, you did what? You know, or how did you handle that? You know, so I think it's, for me, you got to understand there's a process you respect. It may happen or it may not. Second part of it is as in a team sport, and I can't speak to the individual sports, but you got to frame up what your sacrifice is and what your service is. You know, if you're the star player, that's one thing. But if you're on a team, there's service work. So how are you going to handle this? They're both very important parts of giving, being a part of a team. can't just be always about you. Mm-hmm. So we try to impress the chemistry component of, you know, how are we all going to get along? How are we all going to play in the same sandbox? And sometimes that's harder than you think.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and especially as I've watched our process with volleyball, because again, I don't come from a team sport background, and I was a gymnast and then a diver. And like, I tried team sports, but I had been an individual athlete for so long. I didn't operate well on a team sport because I didn't understand why I had to keep doing the things that I had already figured out. So that, like, I didn't grow up learning that. So watching my daughter's process and how it works, and they're on new teams, you know, every year, and a different one for, like, you know, whether it's school ball versus the club ball. And so it's like, you're always with these different people too. And so what is some advice for kids coming up, whether they're just getting started, they're looking toward college, like, you know, junior high to high school level, like, what is some of the best advice you could give to them? What to focus on, how to think about things? Like, what are some of the things that you would say?
One of the challenges you touched on that I feel is tough for adolescents is that change. Okay, so club sports, every year you matriculate with a different coach. High school, same thing. So transitioning, and I'm sure this is happening for all sports, all age groups, but you hear so many different pieces of information that it's really hard. Like, what do I trust? You can't go through your development trying to execute everything everybody says every 6 months because it just doesn't get you on a constructive path. So I really try to, you know, support kids, you know, do some research. You know, I know you said you watched a Google or a YouTube video and you kind of understand what it's about, but add this to your homework list, you know, go to some places, drill into some coaching clinics, find what you can, whose technique, and find the top three people that you believe, you know, I don't care who they are, but see what they're teaching. See what, if they have anything to have to say, how does it compare to what you're doing now? How does it compare to what you've been taught? You know, because one of the most frustrating things as a coach, and it pains me for the kids, is that they've matriculated 3 years on a bad instruction, a bad, this is the way you need to do it. And all of a sudden, I got to try to unwind that to unlock the next level of, honey, you're not going to get looked at until this gets cleaned up. And so I'm sorry that somebody told you this was the end of the greenest grass on earth, but that's frustrating. And it's more of a criticism in general. Coaches don't have a lot of time to drill down, but there's a lot of coaches these days that haven't played at high levels. So
that's really an important thing that is foreign to me too, because I had the same coach from the day I stepped onto the pool deck until I retired. You know, and I did go to college and have another coach at college, but I would come home in the summers and I would still train with my club coach. And so, you know, and he's had assistants and other people, and that's changed a little bit over time, but it was always like you have the same crew for a very long period of time. So yeah, when I'm seeing my daughter have a different coach on every year and a different group of girls she's having to connect with, then gets connected, then you get ripped away because you're trying out and you're on a new team. Like, I guess, how do you roll with those punches a little bit? Like, I like that you said, kind of go to the clinics, like find the people that you really like, how they're teaching the technique, kind of stick with those. But with the like moving of the teammates and things too, and the consistent voice that you're going to hear, like, how do you roll with those punches well?
It's really tough. I mean, and to these ends, I think the kids are being disserved on some level because of this transitory progression. I do feel like you said that you operate best under a longer term contract, so to speak, with guidance and supervision, because the trust and respect can translate into a longer term plan. Plans take time. That's the thing about club sports, is that coaches pretty much has an objective for the year. There's not a whole lot of personal development. So that, unfortunately, is where either a financial burden comes in for personal development through private instruction, which is actually how I got started coaching. I was doing private instruction for 2 years and that was it, you know, working one-on-one. And it allowed me to say, look, you know, you're good, but these are my bullet points. This is what needs to happen. And lo, you know, fortunately, 80% of the time, my suggestions and plans are working out. So slowly there was some feedback in the community that, look, this guy has some good information. But more often than not, a kid is getting questionable information on 100%. Well, how do I put this? On 100% of the problems, a kid's probably getting decent information 50 to 60% of the time that I would trust.
So what would
going
you
forward?
What would you advise for parents then? If they're watching their kids, they're trying to help them kind of level up to that. Like, what would you tell the parents? Like, whether it's seeking out some kind of personal develop, whether that's mentally or physically, I guess, depending on the kid, or going toward college. Cause there's a whole other thing too, with like college volleyball is like really high level, it seems. And I know it's it can be very political and it can be a whole lot of things. So like, what kind of advice do you have for parents and kids looking toward that angle of things?
You know, and this comes down to wherewithal and capability, but the college, if you want to address, most college programs have summer programs, summer camps. Those are actually great avenues because they get not only their own coaches from their teams to participate, they get alumni. So if you have a kid that kind of knows somewhere out in the future, like, let's say, what did you say? Your daughter was 12 or 13. So this may be a year or two ahead of her, you know, and again, it's more of a barrier to entry if it's on the East Coast, you know, like if she wants to go to an Ivy League school. But at some point, it's going to pay dividends to go attend one of those to see what they teach, you know, to meet the coaches. It's probably the best environment, the best natural environment, because recruiting has so many limitations on in-person visits. You're connecting by text at a certain point. If you're not an already sought out program or an already tabbed, you know, these days it's pressing down to 16 by the time these colleges can contact. So at 14 or 15, I think it makes a boatload of positive sense to go get out there and be your bubbly little self and go show your stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for learning and it's an opportunity for you to network, you know? And then maybe try that at three different camps. You know, they're no different cost than it is to go to your club. They might even be less expensive. I don't know. Pick three schools and try it, you know? I think the other one is you really got to seek out. There are people in each region that are kind of best in class about their coaching and their instruction. And it comes down to 13 or 14, try to get the best eye that you can on your kid by paying for a series of private instructions to say, how do you teach this technique? You know, this is kind of where he or she is right now. You know, can we spend 5 or 6 multi-hour sessions and just, I would really appreciate your feedback, you know, in conjunction with a coach that maybe oversees her. But you'd be surprised what, you know, once you piece together some of the information. So again, it's kind of a fact gathering mission. And I think not to put anything else on parents' plates, you got enough to do. But if you're going to be involved, do it with your son or daughter, you know, or you know, whatever gender we're talking about here, of collectively researching and brainstorming, like, hey, are there any famous alumni that played the sport, you know, or watch some of the junior national tapes. You know, there are obviously a lot of resources these days. So there's different ways to come about it. It's not a straightforward answer.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's just a different sport in the way of, like, I felt like for diving for us, I mean, it was also, diving's more like gymnastics where we are there 30 plus hours a week, you know, spending all that time doing it. And volleyball seems a lot like we're training with the team a little bit here and there, but then you do a lot on your own or with private things or outside of that. So it's just different, you know?
It totally is. In individual sports, I think there is that capability to be more intense and committed on an hourly basis because you can, you know, you're with the same person. It's a totally different dynamic. You don't have 11 or 12 other people to, you know, have plus parents to try to figure out. It's a little smoother. So yeah, it is a different dynamic, but you know, if you ever come across people that are really frustrated, I always try to keep my door open to people about contacting me if they have, you know, serious questions. I know I laugh with Karch, you know, because it's funny to hear him talk about sometimes, like he goes, I don't understand, you know, at club tournaments, why parents are switching ends of the court when their teams switch sides. You know, like, why are they following their kid to the other side? Can't they see the same from here? You know, and I'm kind of laughing, go, yeah, that's a good question, Karch. I actually don't. So,
well, okay. So what would you say then for maybe that athlete who is kind of, you know, they're not out there on the court first. They're more of the bencher. They're getting in occasionally, but they want to be out there and improve. Is it usually your just physical capabilities, or is it sometimes personality? Are there other things you can offer that maybe you're missing? Or what do you think are besides just being physically really good, what are some of the most important things for a volleyball player?
Absolutely. That's a great point. You know, I was one of those guys where I wasn't a proven product. I was drafted as, you know, you've got great potential. There's that box. I've seen less than stellar capability kids, boys and girls, who have such amazing personalities that they are the difference maker in team vibe, which goes a very long way when you interact. That just kind of shows me as a coach that you just got that innate people person sense. And I want you, you know, mm-hmm. I want your kind of people around. Yeah. It's good. It's happy. It's upbeat. And then there's the fact that if you're not on the court a lot, you really got to get serious again to like framing up what your sacrifice is going to be for what you want to end up trying. You've mm-hmm. got to give yourself, you know, okay, if I'm in this and I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years and my parents have invested and I still enjoy this, then I'm obviously working toward X. And if that's getting recruited, okay, maybe if you don't recruit it, the backup is I'm going to be a preferred walk-on or do the walk-on thing, but I'm committed to that path. Mm-hmm. And break it down, you know, look at your technique. Really, again, kind of research players, older players, you know, collegiate players you like that you follow. And don't look at the game. Look at their feet. Look at what they're doing. Look at what they're doing when they're not around the ball. You know, try to break down tape. You know, it's almost like a video analysis exercise without the coaching instruction of telling you what to look at, or this is an offense and this is their patterns, or this is their defense and this is their likes and their tendencies. You have to be your own surgeon, you know, and kind of get after stuff. You'll vibe. You'll find a technique or like, wow, she was amazing just to watch to play. She's so fluid. She's so beautiful. Or he's so powerful. You know, it's, you'll see, you know, it becomes obvious what the clean, efficient way is.
That's awesome. Okay. So one, maybe final question. So I know since you and I both talked about how like, it's really easy for athletes to get a little bit lost after sport, finding who they are kind of outside of that sport and how life kind of works for them outside of the schedule and what they've known like their whole lives. What advice would you have for athletes who are maybe going into that part? They know they're getting ready to transition to move from athlete to person outside of their sport.
So I would try to condense 15 years of prickly path into, you know, I think the first two train tracks are, do you think you can tolerate or want to go into a traditional work environment? Do you want to follow a corporate thing or kind of a path? And that's a little different than being an entrepreneur. So there's that. There's a lot of people, I didn't think I could do the 9 to 6, you know, or the 9 to 5 or whatever. It's just like, for me, that wasn't it. I was a little more off center, off beat. I'm a little more of a kind of an urban hippie. I'm a massage therapist. I have a real estate license, you know, but you're going to have to get out there and try a couple of things. The first thing may not be the only thing, and it may not be the best thing. So you're, again, back to kind of applying some of the early things you had to do as an athlete of freshman year, sophomore year. You got to grind it out. You know, this is a learning experience as much as anything else. So the hardest thing to do is to put down your story, your old story, and not kind of lean so deep into that you're really not kind of humbled on what has to happen ahead. You know, or if you have a passion, it took me a while to kind of find my heartfelt thing. I was so caught up in what should I do? You know, I'm a Stanford graduate. All my friends are doing this, or everybody's almost done, you know, I mean, and I'm just like, oh my God, I went the more alternative path, which is more health, healing, kind of well-being kind of thing. And I'm grounded with that. So you really got to, I think, A or B, you know, thicken your skin around what people are going to tell you should be doing. It is a personal journey. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you are the only person that can go through that. But it's important to voice or express yourself for support or talk or, you know, like, hey, I'm bouncing on the walls here and I'm doing this. You know, you got to find your community. And then second or third, I would be like, what's your legacy? Is there anything that you want to leave behind? Does it have to do with your sport? Does it have to do with what your experience was? It matters somewhere to somebody. And usually it matters to more people than just one person. You know, is there a way for you to kind of really step into that and make that a heart-driven purpose to make change and engage to affect things?
I love that. I think that's great advice. John, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your whole journey from beginning.
Awesome, Laura. Thank you so much. You're a really good conversationalist and you really hit on some solid things. So I'm really honored to be on the show and thank you very much.
We need to know and we need to let athletes know that we are more than just athletes. Like there's so much more involved in our stories and in who we are as people, and our sport is just a small, small part of our journey. So thank you for sharing that and being so open with us, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. This allows us to keep bringing on amazing guests, and it also helps other athletes to find this show. Make sure to check out the show notes to follow us on social media and learn more about our awesome guest. To hear all of our amazing episodes, head on over to thepursuitofgold.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Pursuit of Gold is proud to be a Podigy production. That's all for now. Make sure to tune back in next week.